This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up later, we'll hear the case against historic preservation districts as politicians in Wisconsin and our neighbors in Michigan look to reform some parts of the state laws. First, it's our weekly check-in on the latest in national politics. The South Carolina Republican primary is just around the corner, as is the Nevada caucus. Joining us to talk about what we can expect from voters and how the passing of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia will affect the presidential race is Harry Enten, senior political writer for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, let's visit South Carolina first. Republican primary coming up this weekend. You're watching the numbers closely there. What are we seeing just a handful of days out?
We're seeing a huge lead for Donald Trump. He's up right now with about 33 to 35% of the vote, depending on the exact poll and which exact forecast that we use here at 538.com. But basically, he's clearly ahead. And then there's a real fight for second place between Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, who seem to be fighting it out in the upper teens. And then the rest is all pretty much scattered, with Bush well down around 10%, about tied with John Kasich.
As South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley is endorsing Marco Rubio, I think we just found that out today. Is that something that's going to make a difference for him?
It could. This is something that, as you said, we just came across the wire over the past few hours. The Haley endorsement is basically the one that has been hanging out there. Lindsey Graham, the senior senator from that state, has already endorsed Jeb Bush, while the junior senator from that state, Tim Scott, had been already endorsed Marco Rubio. Nikki Haley is quite popular in that state, and what I would say what's most important is it's a signal. It's a signal to those voters who want to stop Donald Trump. If you want to get behind one candidate, the candidate you need to get behind is Marco Rubio. It's probably not going to be enough to defeat Donald Trump in that state, but it could make for a strong, or at least a stronger second place finish for Marco Rubio.
I know South Carolina is a place that has been a roadblock for non-establishment approved candidates before. I'm thinking Bush, McCain, 2000. McCain hit a big stumbling block, a very concerted effort there. Is there any indication that the establishment can make a stand that could change those numbers in the next, 5 days?
Right. I mean, they have very little time left to really it's very difficult to imagine them knocking Trump off the perch of which he's at. He's been very stable. If you look at the numbers now versus 2 weeks ago, he's right around, that 33 to 35% of the vote. But it could help stop him from growing support. And more than that, as I said, it could really signal the idea that, hey, if we want to get behind one candidate, be a one anti-Trump candidate, then that candidate is Marco Rubio, which at least if he finishes in a strong second could set him up, get some favorable press going down the road.
Anybody looking at South Carolina maybe as a winnowing tool here? Are there any candidates, if they underperform, who we think might drop out?
Well, I think we continue, some of us continue to wonder why Ben Carson's in there. He's obviously not going to do well on Saturday. Whether or not he gets out, I don't know. And the other question is Jeb Bush. He has not at all really hinted that he's going to get out, but you got to sometimes be honest with yourself. Look in the mirror. He's got the endorsement of Lindsey Graham. He's got the endorsement of other people within that state. He spent a lot of money in that state. If he can't do better than finishing, dare I say, fifth behind John Kasich, then where is he to go? I don't really understand what that's all about. Yes, he has the money, and Right to Rise, the Super PAC, has the money. But he's going to have to face facts sooner or later.
He brought out his brother, former president. That's a big gun. He tweeted a picture of a smaller gun, an actual gun, and both of them seen as maybe backfiring for him.
Yeah, George W. Bush is popular in that state, but, George W. Bush hasn't been president for 8 years. George W. Bush is an old name. Obviously, there was some Twitter reaction to him showing the gun. At this point, though, I there was that whole thing that Donald Trump brought up about Jeb Bush mooning, and that might be, that even if he mooned everybody, probably couldn't get a lot of attention. I just don't really understand what Jeb Bush can do here. He's pulled out all the stops. He's done everything. And the numbers just haven't moved.
Before we turn to the Democratic side of this race, the endorsement primary, you guys are watching this at 538, counting who gets the big name, congresspeople, senators, governors, that kind of thing. Donald Trump, and I assume you've double-checked the addition here, has zero so far.
He has zero. Even Ben Carson got an endorsement from Andy Harris, who's a representative in Maryland. They go back to their Johns Hopkins days together, but that just gives you an idea. Trump has no support. Historically speaking, that has been a death knell. However, this year seems kind of weird already. Maybe it won't be, but I will say that Marco Rubio has picked up, we do endorsement points, they're weighted by importance of position, has picked up 42 weighted endorsement points, including Nikki Haley, since the Iowa caucus. That's nearly half of his total overall. It's clear that if the party is, quote-unquote, deciding on a candidate, it's Rubio. We'll see if he'll be able to do anything with it.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com. Let's head to Nevada now, Harry. Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Democratic caucus. What are we seeing there?
Very tight race and a race in which we don't really know what's going on. The turnout there is going to be very low. There's probably going to be a lot of people who are going to vote in this caucus who haven't voted before. It's certainly a more diverse state than either New Hampshire or Iowa. I would not be surprised if white voters only made up three-fifths of voters, 60% of voters. It's a state that Hillary Clinton should do well in, but it's a state with very few polls. It's a state where turnout, as I said, is going to be very, very low. It could be a lot of hardcore liberals who turn out who could be good for Bernie Sanders. If Sanders wins that caucus, I would argue it's much bigger for him than actually winning in New Hampshire. Does that mean he's going to win the nomination? Of course not. But it could mean that, hey, this is another favorable moment for Sanders. Can we use this win here and then pivot it to South Carolina, which will be a week later? And even though Clinton leads by a lot there, and our models indicate that Clinton's a 99% chance to win, can he at least cut down on her margin there? That could be big for him.
Yeah, I was looking at your projections for South Carolina and then southern states coming up in March, and that is maybe Hillary Clinton's chance to start racking up a bunch of wins here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. If you look at where she continues to do well in the polling, it's in the South, and the reason she does well in the South is that African Americans make up pretty much a majority in almost all of the southern states, the exception being Arkansas, where obviously Clinton has an edge anyway because her husband was governor there. If you look at the polls, she is well up, and it would not be surprising if she builds a 100-plus delegate lead after March 1st. And if she does that based upon the data that we have available now, it's going to be very, very difficult for Sanders to catch her, which is why the caucus this Saturday in that state out in the West is so important, because he needs something to change the game for those March 1st primaries in the South. If he doesn't, he's going to fall behind that delegate count, and it's going to be difficult to catch up.
Harry, debates on both sides over the last week, including Democrats in Milwaukee. Anything came out of those that you think makes a difference in these upcoming caucuses and primaries?
I don't necessarily think so. I think, you know, on the Republican side, what's interesting is that they were able to get Trump a little bit upset, and I think it kind of really was an illuminating moment that Trump is not really a quote-unquote true conservative. And as the party tries to build up an anti-Trump, I think it could be very helpful for them. On the Democratic side, I would say that, no, it was pretty much a draw, but I will say that Clinton finally seems to have at least some sort of message that, hey, economic inequality is important, but it's not only about that. And if she can say that Sanders is a one-issue candidate, which he has not argued successfully so far, then it could be good for her to at least stop the Sanders surge.
Of course, the biggest news over the week, the unexpected passing of Antonin Scalia, Supreme Court Justice. You wrote about this. You crunched numbers from the past. You said best case even for Obama, it would be very hard for him to get a liberal justice, something like Sonia Sotomayor. Why is that?
Because what I essentially did was I modeled basically past nominations since Robert Bork, which was sort of a dividing point, you know, when these confirmation hearings became a lot more vigorous and a lot more fighting that went on in them, divisive. And basically what they showed was that given that Republicans control the Congress right now, it's just going to, and specifically the Senate, it's just going to be very, very difficult based upon what liberal justices tend to look in the Republican senators' minds and eyes. It's just as very, very difficult to imagine that they would be able to get more than 50 votes, yes, but then even 60 votes, because remember, Supreme Court justices, at least nominees, can be filibustered, so you need 60 votes for cloture, and based upon the math in the past, a Sotomayor or a Kagan probably would not be able to reach that 60-vote margin.
So the best bet, if Obama wants to get somebody approved, and if the Senate will try to approve anybody, no matter who it is, a moderate justice.
Right, a moderate and a well-qualified. It's not, I mean, a lot of it is ideology, especially these days, but it's also about qualifications. Remember, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, although that was over 20 years ago, was able to fly through the Senate despite a fairly liberal record. And the reason she was able to do so was because she was seen as so well qualified. So someone who's a moderate, but also someone who has their judicial chops in order.
So do voters watch something like this, a Supreme Court to seat open, the battle over this? Do people vote based on that kind of thing? Is this going to have an impact on elections?
Maybe in the primaries, potentially, but remember, most of these candidates are so ideologically close together, it's kind of difficult. But here's the thing. If you go back to 2012 and you look at the polling, you saw that the Supreme Court, of the issues that was most important to voters, the Supreme Court was near the bottom. Could that change this time around with it actually, you know, a Supreme Court nominee being in the foreseeable future? Sure, it could. But still, the things like the economy, terrorism are likely to be more important in voters' eyes.
Harry, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst at 538.com. He joins us every Wednesday with an update on what's happening in Washington and the world of politics. Coming up, we'll hear the case against historic preservation districts. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel joins us to tell us why the paper's making a big change to the comments on its website. First, there's a renewed debate over the merits of historic preservation designations here in Wisconsin and elsewhere, especially when it comes to privately owned homes and historic districts. Lawmakers in Wisconsin and Michigan have introduced legislation in recent months targeting these designations, saying property owners should have more rights and more flexibility. Well, our next guest disagrees with the thinking behind these arguments from lawmakers. He says there's a case to be made against historic preservation districts because they can stand in the way of affordable housing, which could become increasingly important as a lot of cities confront a growing nationwide housing shortage. Kristen Capps joins us now. He's a writer at City Lab, where he recently wrote about historic preservation districts. Kristen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first off, you're not arguing against the concept of historic preservation, I don't think. You say a lot of buildings are great, they're good to preserve. Houses, though, not always such good candidates for preservation. Why is that?
It's because houses are also assets. Houses are the main mechanism for building wealth in the United States and in capitalism in general. And when you preserve wealth, that often comes to the exclusion of opportunities for creating more wealth for other people who might like to also join in on the American dream.
And talk about how historic preservation designations usually work at the house level and then for a whole district. I assume it varies from state to state, but what are some common themes?
Well, it really does depend very, very widely. You can sometimes find examples of historic homes, homes that have had some historic event or association with those homes, and those can fall into trusts or museums or various kind of avenues for preservation. What I'm more interested in, this particular argument, is about the district level, that is the preservation of neighborhoods or associations of homes that have some architectural style in common. These are some of the most beautiful neighborhoods in the United States. They're also some of the wealthiest.
Right, and that's where you get worried, the idea of historic preservation not really being used mainly to preserve history, but to preserve property values in these districts. Can you flesh out how that works?
Yeah, right. So I don't want to impugn anyone's motives here. I don't think that homeowners who enter into historic districts, who argue for historic districts, are doing so because they think that there is a strict financial incentive for them. There is a strict financial incentive for them in keeping the supply of housing low while they have that housing. That value goes up. It's very simple economics, and all sorts of restrictive land use policies need to be reconsidered given the nature and the scope of our current housing crisis.
So to walk through that a little bit, say I'm a property owner, I'm kind of a historical type of neighborhood. If I and my neighbors can get this designation, that means that down the street they're not going to put up a new affordable housing building. They're not going to put an apartment building up across the street from me. We're going to keep things as they are, and that's going to help keep my property values higher than they would be otherwise.
Yes, that's right. I don't have any truck with the Republican argument that's happening in Wisconsin. I think that argument is rather crass. It's just about giving homeowners more opportunities to do kind of cheap improvements. That's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in the thing you just described, which is how do we expand affordable housing in the neighborhoods that are the nicest, the places where people want to live, where they have nice amenities, great school, safety. As we've seen in a contentious Supreme Court case last year, affordable housing has historically and, you know, to this day been relegated to the poorer and minority neighborhoods across our nation. And that's something that's got to change.
Talking to Kristen Capps from CityLab, he recently wrote about historic preservation districts, their use and misuse. So, Kristen, is there a place to have a residential historic district? Are there places in this country where, hey, yeah, it's worth setting aside this area and preserving it?
This is where it really gets hard to say, because if you look at any particular, you're going to see a great argument. You can look at beautiful Queen Anne's in Wisconsin. You can see them in Washington, D.C., where I live, these old Victorian homes. And they're gorgeous, and no one wants to see them go. But I think that we sometimes need to take a step back from a particular neighborhood and look at the people, look at people who want to live there. I think fundamentally you can save buildings or you can save people, but it is very, very hard to save both.
For historic preservation of non-residential buildings, you're generally okay with that, it sounds like.
Yes, definitely. I think that libraries, churches, museums, marketplaces, these can be incredible community assets. I don't want to pitch an anti-historical argument. I want to see as much preserved as possible. But in housing, when we are talking about the actual distribution of wealth, that gets, I just think, too tricky.
Well, thinking about the historical value of preservation, though, I wonder if there's a case, you know, say you're in Philadelphia and you're in the midst of all those Quaker brick houses or whatever area of the country you want to talk about. It's something to have a bunch of those houses together. It's something different if you've kept one house and then there's, I don't know, a 7-story apartment building next door and a Quickie Mart on the other side of it. Does that take away some of the historical impact?
Maybe it does. I'm willing to acknowledge that it might. I don't want to lie to you and say that a Quickie Mart looks great next to, you know, a beautiful old standalone single-family house. But we're not in the midst of a cultural crisis in the United States. We're in the midst of a housing crisis. We've got to get some affordable housing up, and we've got to distribute it equitably. So I'm torn. I don't want to see these neighborhoods come down, but I don't want to see people suffer more than they have. So will a single apartment building ruin an historic neighborhood? No, of course not. Of course not. And I think that every time an apartment building comes up after a long and difficult battle over changing the neighborhood character, we find that the neighborhood survives. We in America, we're strong. We can deal with changing neighborhood character and still preserve our history and our culture.
Well, you know, Kristen, I mean, it seems like the historic preservation part of this is just one small part. And we hear more and more about how we're segregated by wealth, by class here in the United States. Wealthier people, intentionally or not, manage to keep affordable housing from opening in their neighborhoods. Is that a bigger problem than just this one historical preservation piece of the puzzle?
You know, once again, I don't want to impugn anyone. I would hate to give the impression that historical districts are filled with greed or these negative instincts. Rather, it's just that the people who have access to greater wealth and more power and more social organization tend to build these kind of positive feedback loops, where the high income residents come in and they stay there. And they make it easier for high-income residents. And I think that does have a spillover effect on other communities. And you see that play out in our segregated neighborhoods. They are segregated by income. They are segregated by race. There's hardly a major city where you don't see this. There's not a state where you don't see this. So I'm willing to look at everything, even our historic districts, and say, let's put it all on the table. We can preserve what we need to preserve, but right now that's not the crisis we're looking at.
like so many things, Kristen, it sounds like this is a balancing act, a valid desire to preserve historic buildings on the one hand, a valid desire to have housing that people can afford on the other. Do you think that there's enough public participation in these arguments in city councils, among planners, that sort of thing?
Well, in a funny way, there's too much public participation in these arguments. When land use policies are guided or controlled by the people who live on that land, by the neighbors who live on that land, then you get these kinds of positive feedback loops that just continue to bring all the good things to one area and push off all the new development into other areas. So what I would like to see is actually greater kind of regional decision-making, citywide decision-making, less neighborhood-by-neighborhood decision-making, and more kind of assertive community values being placed at high consideration in these debates.
We'll leave it there for now. Kristen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Kristen Capps. He writes for City Lab. We've got a link to his piece on historic preservation on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up, we'll hear how one Wisconsin newspaper is trying to make its online comment section a happier, less mean-spirited place. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up in just a few moments, don't read the comments. That's common advice when reading the news online. We'll talk to the editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a big new change in that paper's comments policy. First, a new paper published today on Neanderthal and modern human interbreeding has scientists questioning what they thought they knew about our relationship with Neanderthals and about our early migrations as humans. Gemma Tarlak is with us now to tell us more. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, good to talk to you again.
Hey, how are you doing?
Well, I'm good. Now, what's the big news out of this paper out today?
Well, this is a really exciting paper for two reasons. Number one, our basic model of human migration out of Africa has always been that we kind of left Africa around 65,000 years or so and made our way northward into Europe and Asia. But one of the things this paper does is show that we apparently left Africa a lot earlier than we thought, more than 100,000 years ago. So that's number one interesting fact about the paper. But the bulk of the paper itself is interesting fact number two. You know, we've known for years that most non-African humans have about 1-4% of our DNA from some very distant Neanderthal ancestor. This paper shows the first example of gene flow from humans, from us, into Neanderthal, so kind of the reverse direction gene flow. And what it tells us is there was a lot more overlapping and interaction and, you know, hooking up and maybe even speed dating between our species and Neanderthals than we thought, and it happened a lot earlier than we thought.
Yeah, these Neanderthal genes are a clock in a way for tracing when we left Africa, because one place Neanderthals never were, as I understand it, was Africa.
That's right. We have absolutely no indication, either in terms of archaeological sites or in terms of the genetic makeup of folks who are from Africa. It really all comes down to that crucial period where modern Homo sapiens were, you know, we evolved in Africa and we left Africa. And again, we thought for a long time it was around 50,000, 65,000 years ago. And at that point, the kind of like just to round it off, 50,000 years ago point, we start to see evidence of Homo sapiens and Neanderthals sharing the same space, potentially interbreeding. That's how non-Africans got 1-4% of the DNA coming from Neanderthal sources. So we're pretty, you know, we feel pretty confident that we know that's what happened. And for a long time, scientists thought that was the first migration of Homo sapiens out of Africa and that there was no overlap, no contact between Neanderthals and Homo sapiens before that. Now we have evidence that, yeah, there was contact and it was more than 100,000 years ago.
So we were in contact and we were interbreeding, if I could be scientific about it, between humans and Neanderthals. Does that means we're not really a separate species? Do I have that right?
Oh my goodness, no, that's kind of going way far off the bend. And by the way, in terms of interbreeding, the actual preferred scientific term is hanky-panky.
Ah, okay.
Just so you know, for future reference. But we had our last common ancestor, Homo sapiens and Neanderthals. The last common ancestor was more than 400,000 years ago, maybe even about 765,000 years ago. And then they split, and a lot of scientists believe that the real split between species was because Homo sapiens kind of stayed in Africa and Neanderthals went up towards the higher latitudes, which, quite frankly, they are much better adapted to the cold than we are. So that's how the split happened, and it happened a long time ago before this. So just the fact that there was interbreeding does not suggest that there's any kind of, you know, one species going on.
Interesting. So the big question when shocking news like this comes out is, what's next? What's our next big questions that this raises?
Well, the fascinating thing, when I was talking to one of the lead researchers on this project, he mentioned that when they saw the results, the team was so surprised by the results, because they didn't go looking for this, that they actually ran the results over and over and were testing them every possible method, like, surely we can't be seeing this. But now that we know that, yeah, there is very strong evidence in the data for interbreeding more than 100,000 years ago, I think the next step, well, there are two different directions to take. Number one, let's try to figure out where the Neanderthals and Homo sapiens bred or interbred more than 100,000 years ago. There are a couple sites in the Near East that are good candidates, but we haven't found any concrete evidence. And we're also going to continue to do just genetic modeling, trying to figure out what exactly happened, how many instances there were, trying to kind of ferret out the details that are all in the DNA.
Let's definitely ferret those out. And I wonder, is our current genetic makeup part of what they're looking at here?
Yeah, you know, there were hundreds of modern humans from all around the world. Their genomes were also part of the data set that they ran the Neanderthal genome against. And so, you know, they're comparing this Neanderthal genome that was originally sequenced in 2013 for the first time. They're running, it's called the Altai Neanderthal, and they're running her genome, it was a female, they're running her genome both against the partial genomes of other Neanderthals, as well as other archaic humans, but also just hundreds of modern humans like you and me who are just sitting on our office chairs or our car seats right now, like, wow, this is exciting.
And I want to talk about, you mentioned trying to find out the where. How big a range do we know that the Neanderthals lived in, that we'd be looking for this sort of interconnection between us and them? I mean, I think of them as, oh, Northern Europe, but it's wider than that, right?
Yeah. I mean, certainly Northern Europe, but, you know, all the way well into Siberia, which is where this individual was found. And, you know, we know that at the time humans were migrating out of Africa in that initial wave, well, in what we thought was the initial wave, 47,000 to 65,000 years ago. We're going to have to revise that figure now, but when humans were coming up from Africa in that wave about 50,000 years ago, there were already Neanderthals like in Turkey and elsewhere in the Levant, in that area of the Middle East. So they were really well distributed. And, you know, the question, what was their range? We won't really know until we find every possible fossil out there. And we've still got a ways to go.
All right, Gemma, get out there and hunt up some fossils for us. And thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha, with us to talk about a new paper just released today about modern human and Neanderthal connections and the travels of early humans around the world. Now, whatever we might think of Neanderthals and their modern-day descendants, they look pretty darn enlightened compared to the behavior we sometimes see in online newspaper comment sections. News sites have struggled with their comment policies for years, often with a sort of a free-for-all attitude, and that's led to a lot of angry arguments, personal attacks, mean-spirited conversation, and worse, even threats and overt racism. Some newspaper sites have changed their policies to try to rein things in. Here in Wisconsin, the Capital Times turned off their comments section just over a year ago. Starting this week, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel says, hey, we're going to limit our comments to paid subscribers. Journal Sentinel editor George Stanley published a piece explaining the new policy and why it was needed, and he joins us now. George, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, to get a sense of what we're dealing with, George, you started your piece with the line, quote, first, we had to eliminate commenting from our obituaries. What was happening?
Yeah, it was terrible. We never expected that. But when we first started providing commenting, people would say under aliases, under anonymous names, just horrible things about people they didn't even know, that they just decided to hate, under their obituaries. So it might be because of their race, it might be because of what they did for a living, it might be who knows what reason, but they would, we didn't think that any grieving family member needed to see that. So that was the first group of stories we had to shut down the comments on.
And that's obituaries. Is that an indication of the tone of comments that you were seeing on the site in general?
Yes, especially for political stories, but it could, any story could be derailed into a political story. So, I mean, we saw feature stories on new businesses that somehow some people would derail into a pretty vicious debate about Scott Walker or Barack Obama or whoever they didn't like, and then they get into it with each other.
And yeah, this isn't just saying, I really hate what candidate or politician X has done to this state or this country. It got way worse than that, right?
Right. An example is a couple weeks ago, we did a big look at, you know, the huge number of homicides we had in Milwaukee last year. We were back up to levels we hadn't seen since the 1990s. And to really show the loss to the city, we put every photograph we could find and get on the front page of the victims. And there were babies and children and very young adults. Very, you know, most people were very young that were murdered in Milwaukee last year. And one person, this never made it to the comments, but one person, it's basically, I won't repeat what he said, but basically it was under an anonymous name again, that he wished the homicide total had been even higher. In a very racist statement. And it was that kind of really, you know, obnoxious, horrendous things that we don't mind when people criticize public officials, elected officials for the job they're doing. That's what the First Amendment's all about. As long as they do it without using profanity, without using racist taunts, without doing personal attacks on the politician's family members or the public official's family members or the other private citizens that are commenting alongside them. And those are the kinds of things that we were seeing and constantly having to take down and revoke people's privileges and those sorts of things.
So talk us through the new policy. What are you trying to try to get this under wraps a little bit?
Well, one of the problems with the old policy was that people could just come back under a new email and a new name, and we didn't know who they were. So we really did this as a first step. Once we could get our circulation system in line with our commenting sign-ins for a one-login system, which we could only do recently, we decided to say, okay, well, at least we'll know who they are, even if they're using a pen name. We will know who they are, and we will be able to enforce the rules. Plus, we thought many of the most obnoxious statements were probably being written by cowards wearing hoods, you know, and that if they knew someone could figure out who they were going to tamp things down or not participate anymore. And the result has been far better than I had even hoped. I really didn't think we would get this far this fast. But we went from having hundreds of comments flagged by our readers every day and our producers having to go through them and deciding whether to kick someone off and suspend them or revoke them or whatever, and to a couple dozen at the most in the last couple days. And almost all the bad commenting has ceased just by requiring them to have a subscription. But we're still seeing many, many comments. So it's really, for example, there's a story on right now about Latino Day and a day without Latinos in Madison and how many state dairy farms are very worried about this because they need immigrant workers to milk their cows because not many kids grow up on farms anymore in the United States, and they're the ones that have the knowledge and experience to work with the animals. So You know, they're really worried that if they go a day without Latinos on their dairy farm, they won't have anyone to milk the cows. And so we have a story about that right now. There is no way last week we could have opened that story to commenting. And it's open to commenting now, and people are having a civil argument, civil statements. They're not being racist. They're not swearing at each other. They're not doing any of the stuff we used to see.
We're talking to George Stanley, editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Starting this week, his paper has a new online comment policy. Only subscribers can comment. It's an effort to reduce the level of nastiness in the comment zone. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you read the comments on online news sites like JS Online? Do you post, or do you stay far, far away? Do you think things have gotten out of hand? Do you like to see tighter restrictions like this? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about online comment sections with George Stanley. He's the editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Starting this week, only subscribers can comment on the paper's website, jsonline.com, part of an effort to have more civil conversation, cut out some of the nastiness. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. What do you think of online comment sections? Do you love them, hate them, avoid them, or hate them, but you just can't tear your eyes away? Do you post? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And George, we heard from Patrick who wrote on Facebook, there are always a few that ruin things for everyone else. And George, did you get the sense that a lot of people might have participated, but they just saw what was going on and steered clear?
That's exactly the case, I think, and I think Patrick hit the nail on the head, and we're seeing that this week. I've been getting emails from readers over a long period of time saying, I can't even read them, let alone participate in them, because they're so awful. And so it was really interesting to me, because this week, when we put the new policy in, I saw one of those readers. I had saved his email for over a year because I was hoping would be able to change the policy someday, and I quoted him in the column, and I saw him, because he used his real name, I saw him in our comments section yesterday, so that was really good to see. But what Patrick said, I think, is exactly what happened. We had a big marketing survey done of our market about 15 years ago, and the group that did it said there's about 10% of the folks in southeastern Wisconsin that hate everything. They especially hate institutions. They hate you. They hate the government. They hate church. They hate everything. And they told us then, don't try to get them. Don't waste any money to get them. They're not your audience. They're not who you serve. And I think that's the people that were engaging in these bad behaviors, and they're not there right now.
That's something. Well, let's go to our callers. We've got John on the line in Grand Rapids. John, hi.
I have read the comments several times. I don't know how helpful they are. I thought perhaps they let people vent a little bit. We have a local newspaper where you have to make comments through, like, your Facebook page. I'm not real savvy with computers, but I think the point is that you cannot be anonymous that way, and that seems to cut down that a lot. But I have to say that since President Obama was elected, I think a lot of this is pure racism. I think racism has gotten worse. I've had friends and relatives use the N-word that I've never even knew had an opinion about race before. And the way that this Congress and the governor from Arizona and several other people have treated the president, I mean, I'm just shocked at how poor the behavior is. It's really amazing to me.
John, thanks for the call. A lot there to get into. George, I mean, do you think that we're getting more racist, or are we just seeing it more because people are putting it out there online?
My guess is it's the latter, Rob. I think that that for some reason people are saying things that I think it's because they're anonymous online. But when it comes to Facebook, we did try that, and there is the option of doing Facebook commenting, and we were actually shocked with what some people were willing to say on Facebook as well, and through their Facebook profiles, We thought that would do the trick, but it really didn't, because some people will say crazy stuff, and I don't know if they don't know how bad they sound or if they just don't care.
Thanks a lot for the call, John. We're talking to George Stanley, editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about online comment sections. We'll go next to Paul in Menominee Falls. Paul, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I read the comments regularly, and sometimes I will say they are insightful, but they are so bitter sometimes. And I think this is a great move by the Journal Sentinel when they went to it. I heard some criticism of it, but I think it's misplaced. I think that what the Journal Sentinel is doing is thoughtful. I guess I would like to know if they are able to track people that continue to make poor decisions online, if they're able to address any of that or not. But at any rate, thanks for doing this. I'm a longtime subscriber, and hopefully this will move us in the right direction.
Paul, thanks for the call. George, on balance, are you getting more comments like Paul's there, or are you getting more complaints over this?
Way more comments like Paul's from our subscribers. It's been almost unanimous. And the ones that, the very few people that have contacted me with questions, and mostly it's been the type of question like, is my privacy at risk or anything like that? And it's not. We have strict privacy guidelines. We're not going to, share that information with anybody. But to what Paul said, too, this does allow us to track a person's history and to know who they are and to suspend them first and tell them why and then eventually revoke their privileges if they keep doing it. But we really haven't seen nearly as much bad behavior since it started. And I think maybe the problem was never our subscribers to begin with. Maybe it was just, people coming at us from talk radio land and what they were listening to and then joining in because they could, and never had any intention of subscribing to the paper.
Very briefly, George, as we wrap up, are you feeling like you can look at your comments section without a foreboding sense of dread?
I am, and it's the first time in a long time that I have. It has not been a good place to be, and one of our producers said that it was very disheartening to see, page after page after page of flag comments where readers would flag somebody for violating the rules and read everything that people were saying. And he said yesterday he looked and there was none during the period that he was assigned to look at them.
We'll leave it there for now. George, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you so much.
That's George Stanley, editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His piece announcing this week's comment section changed is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll continue our series looking at literacy and find out how immigrants and refugees here in Wisconsin are learning the language skills they need to make a new life here in the state. That and lots more coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.